You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 213 by Rudolf Steiner, 13 lectures entitled Human Questions and Cosmic Answers, translated by Elizabeth Marshall. This is the 10th lecture given in Dornach on the 15th of July, 1922. We have to bear in mind that the opponents of what we discussed at the Anthroposophic Congress in Vienna called a meeting in which various people spoke in the materialistic tenor of our times, and at the end of which a doctor with particularly materialistic views summarized the various speeches in a keyword meant to become the motto of the opponents of anthroposophic-oriented spiritual science, the fight against the spirit. It is a fact that nowadays there are people who see the fight against the spirit as a real rallying cry. When such words ring out, we are reminded of how many people there are today, good-natured, well-meaning human beings, who are trapped in a kind of sleep with regard to what is happening in the civilized world, and who refuse to see the direction we are headed in. They mistake the most significant phenomena for unimportant contemporary events or for the opinion of someone or other, whereas, in fact, a strong tendency in the actual development of humanity is asserting itself today. And really, all those who have an understanding of what is happening should be intensely involved from their hearts with assisting in this development. I have tried to show by means of two personalities how people with more depth have experienced modern intellectual development. I compared these two personalities, Franz Brentano and Friedrich Nietzsche, so as to show you, through them, how people from very different fields, who were at first strongly oriented to the spiritual, then in a sense foundered on contemporary scientific thinking. When we look at actual people whose fate this was, then we can perhaps feel more moved than if we just consider these matters abstractly. With Brentano, I wanted to show how a personality who grew up and was educated in a completely Catholic environment had retained this disposition toward the spiritual world that Catholicism had planted in his soul for the whole of his life. It is exactly someone like Franz Brentano, born in 1838, so that he grew up in those times when the scientific way of thinking of the 19th century was flooding through all aspects of research and human intellectual ambition, who can show us what lingered on from the old ways of looking at the world. When we look at the young Brentano, who studied at the Catholic Theological Seminary, then we see how his soul was filled with two things which at first guided him safely. The one is the Catholic teaching of Revelation, which he accepted, as did all theologians of the Catholic Church since the Middle Ages. The Catholic Revelation on all things spiritual is traditionally accepted. They accepted that there was a kind of grace which revealed to humanity knowledge of the spiritual worlds. For Brentano, this was linked to the second aspect, where he tried to understand what had been received through the Catholic teaching of Revelation. This was Aristotelian philosophy, that philosophy which was developed in ancient Greece. And so, until the middle of the 1860s, perhaps slightly longer, Brentano's soul life was such that in the sense of the medieval scholastics, he would have said, "We should receive what humanity knows about supersensible beings as the Church reveals it, and we can use thinking to examine nature and life according to the teachings of that great teacher of this way of knowledge, the Greek philosopher Aristotle." In their soul life, medieval scholastics combined these two things, Aristotelianism and the Catholic doctrine of Revelation, and saw them as compatible. This lived on in Franz Brentano. However, He was deeply shaken in this view when he was faced with scientific methods. So shaken, in fact, that when he began his lectureship in Würzburg, he had to make the case that the methods of philosophy must be exactly those of natural science. And he wanted to establish a psychology, a study of the soul, in which soul life is examined in the same way as science examines natural phenomena. Thus we can say that this person has experienced a radical turnaround. He wanted to combine knowledge through revelation with knowledge gained through reason and limited to earthly matters. Hence his assertion that only what has been found through scientific methods can be considered science. We should try to empathize with what this radical change meant for him. I want to draw your attention, firstly, to the fact that until this turnaround, the medieval scholastic outlook illuminated an exceptional personality. Even today, this outlook continues to influence many contemporaries of an honest Catholic persuasion, and even many an honest adherent of Protestantism, when in a slightly different form. I have brought Nietzsche into this because, although Nietzsche did not have this continuance of medieval scholasticism, something else lived on in his soul, namely, what emerged as a kind of reaction to scholasticism during the Renaissance. Nietzsche had a kind of Greek artistic wisdom, which formed the basis for his whole view of the world. He had this just as did the people of the Renaissance. However, the people of the Renaissance did not have this impulse or tendency to deny the reality of the spiritual. They still sensed, still felt the reality of the spiritual. Thus in Nietzsche, too, something from olden times had survived in his soul. And as I described to you yesterday, he too had to immerse himself in the scientific worldview of the 19th century, and he completely lost the connection of his soul to the spiritual. In what I have mentioned here lie immensely significant riddles for the contemporary seeker after truth. Let us look at the two spiritual currents which flow into medieval scholasticism. Let us try to illuminate what is here the case. I would like to do it as follows. Within medieval scholasticism, we have a number of, let us say, tenets about the supersensible world. For example, about the Trinitarian nature of the primordial spiritual being, about the incarnation of the Christ in the body of Jesus of Nazareth, a whole series of tenets, of which we have to say that they are not related to the sense world, but to the supersensible world, and which were discovered long ago by human beings who were initiates. Of course, we should not imagine that something like the tenet of the Trinity or of the Incarnation were simply invented by someone in order to dupe people. Rather, these tenets are the results of experiences of erstwhile initiates. Only later did people start to see them as supernatural revelations. Such tenets were found through the experience of initiation. Only later, they no longer recognized that a person could undergo such an initiation and so, for example, experience the vision of the Trinity for themselves. Something like this only becomes dogma when the origins of knowledge have been lost. When someone is an initiate and has a vision of the Trinity, then for them it is not a dogma, but an experience. When, however, someone asserts that to see the Trinity is an impossibility, that it is a revelation and has to be believed, then that is a dogma. Of course, it is not legitimate to disdain dogma as such, but rather what is questionable is a certain attitude that people have toward dogma. If we can trace back those dogmas with a deeper spiritual content to the form they had when an initiate first uttered them, then they cease to be dogmas. However, in the Middle Ages, people no longer wanted to tread the path that they would have had to follow in order to be able to see such things. They had the old tenets that had once been the wisdom of initiation. They had become dogmas which had to be believed. They had to be accepted as knowledge through revelation. This was the one tendency, knowledge through revelation. The other was knowledge through reason, which the medieval scholastics learned according to the teachings of Aristotle. They thought as follows. To a certain extent, we can investigate nature through this knowledge of reason. We can also draw logical conclusions from its findings, for example, the conclusion that God must exist. We are not able to find the Trinity, but we can come to the reasonable conclusion that there must be a God, and that the world had a beginning. This was knowledge through reason. Medieval scholastics also accepted certain conclusions of rational knowledge that came very close to the supersensible, but they did not concede the vision of the supersensible. However, they did accept rational conclusions through which they could approach such things as the existence of God or the beginning of the universe, although it was not possible to actually understand the knowledge of revelation. These truths, which can be found through reason, are called preambula fidei, or preambles of faith, and they can form a basis for advancing into what can never be known through reason and should be the content of revelation. Now that we have looked at these two spiritual currents side by side, let us examine the mind of someone who has them coexisting in their soul. I have spoken about this several times in the last 2 years. In the days when scholasticism was blossoming, what lived in the scholastic was not the evil that ignorant people have called it. Rather, at a certain time in medieval development, it was simply what this development needed. At a certain point in time, no other view was possible. Today, of course, such things are outdated. Today, we must find other methods of cognition and of human soul activity than those that were fitting for scholasticism. Therefore, we have to take care to investigate scholasticism with understanding. And we can only do this when we ask ourselves how knowledge through revelation and knowledge through reason, based on the study of natural phenomena and on conclusions drawn one-sidedly from these phenomena, could exist together in the soul of the honest scholastic. How did they coexist? What did such scholastics want? And with them, all their faithful, all those honest Catholics, when they put themselves in the soul mood of the revelations and said, "We should not try to see what dogmas give us. No vision is possible. We have to accept them as revelations." The scholastics tried to evoke a certain soul mood toward the supersensible world. They were completely convinced that this supersensible world exists and is intimately connected to what lives in the human being as their soul. However, they did not seek a path of knowledge in the human being, directly in their own personality, which could reach into the supersensible world so intimately connected to them. Now try to imagine this mood. It was a mood related to what I would call a known unknown, or a familiar stranger, someone we should honor and revere, but toward whom we should also feel awe, so that we do not care to raise our eyes to theirs. Next to this, there was the knowledge of reason. Scholastic reason was extremely acute, at a level which has never been achieved since. We could wish, as I have said many times here, that those people who study science today would learn to think as astutely as the scholastics could. It was a knowledge through reason which denied itself access beyond a certain border. Knowledge through revelation on the one side, knowledge through reason on the other. But if we compare consequently the knowledge through revelation and knowledge through reason of the scholastics with similar entities of today, then we will find a great disparity. The scholastics said to themselves, "With your knowledge, you should not go into that realm where you should have only revelation. You should not, for instance, enter into a vision of the Trinity or of the Incarnation." However, in the revelations that they received from their church, there were ideas about the Trinity, ideas about the Incarnation. There were descriptions. They told themselves that cognition cannot approach these things, but still, we can think them. As long as we have thoughts corresponding to what has been revealed. You cannot say that the medieval scholastics had a dark and mystic feeling about the supersensible, This is not true. It was a skilled way of thinking in structured concepts, which encompassed the contents of the revelations. They thought about the Trinity, they thought about the Incarnation. However, they did not think as we do when thoughts are something we arrive at ourselves, but as one thinks when thoughts are given by revelation. You see, this too corresponds to a particular precedent of higher cognition. Nowadays, there are people who still have certain atavistic clairvoyant visions, as we could call it, dreamlike imaginations. There are even people who, in such atavistic visionary imaginations, can, for example, attain visions of old Atlantis. This is still possible today. And do not think that in the clairvoyant imaginations such people have, no thoughts exist. Such clairvoyants often have thoughts more structured than those of our peculiar logicians, who have learned to think in the modern school. Sometimes we could despair of the logic used by people who learn to think in the modern school, whereas we need not despair of the logic revealed in this atavistic clairvoyance. It has often been developed in the most stringent manner. We can still show proof today for the way that in what has been revealed through supersensible means for human understanding, thinking also lives. This is also true of medieval scholasticism. It is only in recent times that people think that knowledge through revelation should be free of thinking, so that today faith should filter out of its content not only cognition, but also thinking. Medieval scholastics did not do this. They filtered out cognition, but not thinking. If you study the dogmatic theology of medieval scholasticism, you will see it dominated by a strictly formed system of thinking. This lived on in someone like Franz Brentano. This is why he could think, he could form thoughts. You can see this even in the rudiments of his title, Psychology, of which he only managed one volume. You can see that he has a certain inner structure in the formation of thoughts, despite the fact that he trips himself up again and again in the worst possible way, and so cannot progress. As soon as he has a thought about some soul formation, and he has such thoughts, he forbids himself to think about it. Such prohibition is exceptional these days. I have already told you how a very ingenious man, who wrote the book titled The Whole of Philosophy and Its End, said to me in Vienna, not so long ago, "I have my own thoughts about what is behind events as the primordial factors." But scientifically, he does not allow himself these thoughts. We could even imagine that hypothetically, of course, a person schooled in scientific thinking suddenly through a miracle becomes clairvoyant, and that they would struggle against this clairvoyance in the worst possible manner. Hypothetically, we can imagine this quite easily, because the tendency to cling to external authority is enormously strong. So, knowledge through revelation lived in the soul of a medieval scholastic in a completely concrete form. On the other hand, there was knowledge through reason, which focused on nature, but was not exactly like our modern knowledge of nature. Just to corroborate this, open a book about natural history, for example, one by Albertus Magnus. There you will find natural objects as also described today, but here they are described differently. Alongside this, you will find all kinds of elementary and other spirits. Then the spirits still lived in nature, and natural history and natural science were not just described in the most arid way as they appear to the external senses. These two things coexisted. What was given through revelation, where cognition was forbidden, but which was still thoughts, so that it could be reached through the thinking of the human spirit, and what was found through reason, which however still had spirit, but was, nevertheless, something that had to be investigated in order to discover its true reality. Knowledge of nature has developed out of the scholasticism of the Middle Ages. The one branch of scholasticism, knowledge through reason, has evolved further and become modern natural science. But what are the consequences? Try to imagine the scholastic view of nature as vividly as possible. there are still spiritual aspects in there. What did these spiritual aspects protect the medieval scholastic from? Perhaps I should illustrate this with a diagram, and there are diagrams. Let us assume that here is a medieval scholastic with their longing for revelatory knowledge going upward, and that for rational knowledge going downward. However, in the rational knowledge, there is also spiritual, so I will put some red there too. And in the revelatory knowledge, there is also thinking, so I will put some yellow in there. Now, where does this rational knowledge want to go? It wants to go out to all the objects and phenomena which surround us. The thoughts we then make want to connect with the objects. You will not want to recognize a plant or get an idea of the plant without reckoning with the fact that the idea connects with the plant. It wants to connect with the plant. However, for the scholastic, the spiritual aspects, which still permeate their rational knowledge, hinder their ability to connect fully down here. It does not completely connect. Something is thrown back. So where does it not connect? When, namely, our modern intellectual, rational cognition connects with external nature, when it completely connects, then it connects fully with the Aramanic. So what does the spirituality of the medieval scholastic mean in relation to their rational cognition? Basically, it means that with their rational cognition, they want to reach something which, however, burns a little, but they feel the burn and recoil from it again and again. Nature is sin. They are on guard against Ahriman. But in the 19th century, further development then threw out all the spiritual from rational cognition. And so rational cognition then connected fully with the Ahrimanic. And what does this rational cognition that is connected fully to the external Ahrimanic say? It says that the world consists of atoms, and the movement of atoms is the basis for all scientific knowledge. It explains warmth and light as the movement of atoms. It explains everything in the outside world as being the result of atom movements, since this satisfies our need for causal explanations. In 1872, Dubois Raymond gave his famous lecture in Leipzig about the limits of our knowledge of nature. This is the lecture in which the rational cognition of the scholastics has advanced as far as throwing out all the spiritual. With the motto, ignoramus et ignorabimus, we do not know and will not know, the human mind is meant to connect fully with the Ahrimanic. And Dubois Raymond describes quite vividly how a human head, which now knows about all the atoms which swirl around in the universe, does not see green, nor blue, nor any color at all, but only perceives all around it the movements of atoms. We do not feel warmth. Rather, everywhere there is warmth, we feel the movement of which I spoke to you here 8 days ago. With the power of suggestion, he denies that all colors, warmth, states, sounds, and so on exist. He fills his head with an understanding of the world in which it consists only of atoms. Just imagine, the whole world thinks of such a head as consisting only of atoms. He has in mind that already at that point in time where Caesar crossed the Rubicon, there existed in the cosmos this particular constellation of atoms. Now he only needs to set up the differential equation, and then by further calculation, he can find the next constellation, and the next, and so on. Now he can calculate the most distant future. As this was an idea of Laplace, Dubois Raymond called this the Laplace equation, or the head of Laplace. So in 1872, we had the description of an intellect which could grasp the whole wide universe, that everything is the movement of atoms, and we need only know the differential equation and integrate it in order to have the cosmic formula. But what have we really achieved here? What we have achieved is learning to think like Ahriman, like the Ahrimanic ideal of thinking. We can only learn the real significance of what happens in time when we know what it really is. The lecture about ignorabimus will go down in the history of modern culture, but we will only recognize its value, its real significance, when we are in a position to show how the one branch of scholasticism connected fully with the Aramaic. You see, the scholastics held their knowledge, so to speak, in abeyance. They could not completely reach what was in the outside world. They always recoiled cognitively from Ahriman. This is why they needed to develop such extremely ingenious concepts. These ingenious concepts still have to be developed through human creativity. In order to carry out experiments, all you need from human creativity is the capacity to assemble the necessary apparatus and so on. But the ingenuity of scholastic thinking was not suited to this. This means it was a watershed event, as rational thinking connected completely with the Aramaic. Because what you see around you, outside, as the sensual phenomena of the world, as your sensual environment, this only exists as long as the earth exists. When the earth perishes, all this perishes with it. What lives on are the thoughts which connected with this external reality. When something is thought as Laplace thought, or as what Dubois-Raymond presented as an ideal of scientific thinking, this does not mean that it has merely been thought, but rather these are thought realities which connect to the external. And when all that we perceive with our senses on the earth has perished, these thoughts can live on, if they are not obliterated beforehand. Hence, when something like this becomes the general way of thinking, there is a real danger that our earth will be transformed into a planet which corresponds to the ideas of the materialists. Materialism is only a mere doctrine, as long as it does not gain reality. But this is exactly what the Aramaic powers are striving for, that materialistic thoughts become so strong and so prevalent that all that will be left of the earth are the atoms. When we say nowadays that we have to explain everything in terms of atoms, this is a fallacy. However, if all human beings start to think that everything has to be explained in terms of atoms, when all humanity embraces the Laplace formula, then the earth will actually turn into atoms. It is not correct that the earth has always consisted of atoms and their components, but human beings can actually cause this. This is the essential point. It is not just the tendency for human beings to have false ideas, but these false ideas create false realities. When false thoughts become prevalent, they create realities. This Aramaic danger is already present today. The medieval scholastics tried to avoid the other danger, inherent in cognition through revelation, by clothing these revelations in thoughts. The contents of the revelations became concrete thoughts. This thinking through of the dogmas, however, faded in time, so that many were gradually abandoned. And of course we should abandon what is not understandable. This is, on the one hand, completely legitimate, and when people can no longer follow the dogmas as far as a real vision, then it is self-evident that they should be dropped. However, what do they then develop into? Then they develop into the most abstract thoughts of a dependency on something vaguely eternal or infinite. Then the thoughts which carry revelations within themselves are no longer vividly formed, but there is just the dark, mystic feeling of a kind of dependency on something vaguely eternal. Then the thought content disappears altogether. This is what has happened in recent times. It leads us to Lucifer. And just as the path of cognition through reason has led us to Ahriman, so the other path can lead us to Lucifer. And now look at such a spirit as Franz Brentano in terms of what I have just described. Franz Brentano approaches nature with the feeling, "Do not touch Ahriman." And he approaches the supersensible world with the feeling, "Do not touch Lucifer." Thus, do not become atomistic, do not become mystical. And with this feeling he turns to natural science, which is already such a powerful authority, so that he has to subjugate himself. He describes soul phenomena within the framework of the scientific method. If he had started out from a more superficial point of view, as do many contemporary psychologists, then he would have written an Aramonic psychology, a, in quotes, study of the soul without the soul. But he could not do this. This is why he let it be after the first volume, and never wrote the following books. It was meant to be four. Because there was something in him which would not allow him to think in such a way as to connect completely to Ahriman. Now, take Nietzsche. Nietzsche was just as taken with natural science. But how did he understand science? He paid little attention to specific methods, but studied scientific thinking in general. He said to himself that the soul is based on physiology and is human, all too human. What are supposed to be divine spiritual ideals are in reality an expression, a manifestation of this human, all too human. He rejected that form of knowledge, which we find in Brentano, rational cognition. He cultivated the will in himself. And as I said yesterday, Nietzsche hammered down the ideals, the spiritual. This is another phenomenon where a person comes, in a sense, into the Aramonic, but collides with it. Instead of connecting with the Aramonic, he collides with it. He wants to develop atomism, but instead he collides with it as with a wall. And so we see how such minds of the 19th century developed their specific soul mood through coming so close to what we would call the Aramonic powers. It is the fate of such spirits in the 19th century to come so unbelievably close to Ahriman. And then they either get into the position of Brentano and go no further, recoiling just at the border, or they start to struggle, as did Nietzsche. But it is the forces of Ahriman which have surged up in this 19th century and then greatly influenced the 20th century. We should be aware of this. And the original minds who experienced this partly disguised encounter with Ahriman in the 19th century suffered this tragic fate. And their students were then the recipients of their deliberations. These deliberations lived on in them, and Ahrimanic forces had also worked on these deliberations. The first original minds recoiled from Ahriman. Their students received incomplete Ahrimanic thoughts. They are now at work in them as, quote, the struggle against the spirit, close quote, against that spirit which refuses to abandon the earth to the Ahrimanic powers, hate of the spirit, war against the spirit. Today we have to see that as the actual situation. It lives on as a mood of the times, as a condition of the soul. We have to understand this so that we become really aware how necessary it is that we assert the reality of a spiritual worldview in all the various cultural forms in which such a worldview expresses itself. The end of Lecture 10.